May I speak to you in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Please be seated. Well, it's great to be with you today. I always look forward to Holy Week. I always look forward to having my own senses reenact the great journey of this week, the salvation that is coming to the world. Well, it's hard to believe, but most of what we call the West has bought into a large-scale conspiracy theory. Now, I'm not talking about a particular election, say the latest U.S. election, or wild theories about COVID, where it comes from, and who's behind it, and all of that sort of thing, or even more nutso notions like the moon landings were simply staged in a warehouse somewhere. I actually know people who believe that. I'm talking about a conspiracy that is so large and so pervasive that it's been going on, different strengths and variations, for the past 1700 years. Now, to understand how it might have gained traction, we have to understand that in the face of violence, especially ongoing systemic violence, people will make compromises in order for that to stop. Plans and decisions will be taken that seem reasonable and good at the time, but end up causing great harm later on. Kind of the basic law that applies to human decisions in general, the law of unforeseen consequences, if you will. In this case, I'm talking about the widespread and often very violent persecution of Christians by the Roman Empire. Instead of stamping Christianity out, the harder Rome tried to persecute the Christians, the more the converts kept coming. The ferocity of the violence seemed in many ways to spur on more interest and therefore more growth in the churches. This all reached a head at the end of the 3rd century under the emperor Diocletian. Right after him, Constantine, his son, took over and he restored the rights of Christians. And then had a famous vision at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, in which apparently the Christian God appeared to him. Now, at that point, Constantine, being a pagan, thought in terms of gods, not the one God. And said in the vision, "By this sign, conquer." The sign being the sign of the cross, in the form of the key row, the first 2 letters of the name Christ, in Greek at least. From this point forward, the conspiracy began. As it became apparent to the emperor's advisors and to church leaders that a prudent arrangement could be made, in their minds, needed to be made, in which the church, with its explosive growth, would be protected from further persecution, provided, and this is the rub, that the ordinary power structures of empire were not attacked in the churches. The way this worked out practically is that the church dealt with the peace of the soul, life after. Well, the state was free to deal with everything else. Now, that's oversimplifying because at different points in the church's history, the church actually tried to deal in everything and tried to take over from the state. But in the main, that arrangement held. This meant that despite all of its advocacy for the poor, its advocacy for the sick and the abandoned, and a whole raft of amazing cultural, artistic, and spiritual achievements, things we're still learning from and about, that the church's leaders and the church as a whole conspired for centuries with empire, and later with the leaders of city and nation states, in their various political, economic, and social structures. Now, I'm not trying to be an armchair critic with this today. As someone from the outside, obviously by what I'm wearing, I'm on the inside. I don't think the conspiracy was totally avoidable. But we also must admit that it has led to some of the worst moments imaginable in church history. The Anglican Church's collaboration in chattel slavery. The majority of the German Lutheran Church's collaboration with Nazism. Anglicans in this country have been shocked to learn that they've participated, unwittingly often, in cultural genocide when they meekly acquiesced to becoming agents of the government in running the residential schools. Now, I start this sermon on this Lenten note, but Holy Week is ultimately a week of supreme hopefulness, so I promise I'll get there. One of the unforeseen benefits of the end of Christendom, with all of its gifts and beauties, is an exposure of this conspiracy. The next few decades will radically reshape the church. The process has begun. Part of the remaking, rethinking, reevaluating is that it is a realization, I should put it this way, that for God, for God's kingdom, there has never been these sorts of compromises or separations. There has never been a division between the spiritual and the political. God's vision is one of wholeness for the human race, of everything interrelated, starting with earth and heaven, a desire from God for genuine partnership with all human beings and God's divine energy and love. This will challenge all human structures and institutions, even as it works within them, for their reform and as they continue to be broken. Now we begin to see some of the radicalness of that here at the beginning of Holy Week. The so-called triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem. You'll decide how triumphal it really is. Jesus and his followers climb the hills from the lowest spot on earth, Jericho, beside the Dead Sea, 427 meters below sea level, the lowest elevation on land anywhere on earth, thus the Dead Sea. The water has absolutely nowhere else to go. As they climb, they're not thinking about dead or death. Their emotions are heightened. It's Passover time, the annual celebration of freedom from slavery. But of course, this has always been complicated in recent centuries by the fact that different empires have their thumb on the Israelites. At present, it's the Romans. Jesus' followers have some reason to believe, however, that this Passover will be different. That somehow, in and through this man, that this will be more than a remembrance of the past, a freedom past, but a new declaration of freedom now. That somehow a stronger appearance of God's kingdom, God's saving presence, will be revealed in a new way. That God will declare Jesus the true King. As they reach the top of the hills and descend toward the Golden City, the emotion of the moment reaches its climactic height, and the crowd around Jesus, as soon as he's seated on the colt, lay their cloaks down in front of him, wave their palm branches for his entrance into the city. Actions that were familiar to the Israelites. This is how they welcomed Judas Maccabeus several centuries before. A king, it's a welcome for a king. But, and this is really the nub and rub of their political conundrum and ours, their hope for salvation is really a hope for themselves at the expense of others. In this case, in their case, the defeat of the Romans. They hoped that Jesus would conspire with them, frankly, and by this sign conquer. That this entrance into Jerusalem would herald a new acceptance of the Jesus movement by the crowds and the religious leaders, and that the tide would begin to turn against their enemies. But what happens, of course, is something quite different, something more tragic, and yet ultimately more transformative. For what Jesus does is really a challenge to all politics, whether on the right or on the left, along with the promise that God is committed to bring about the true reign of justice beyond and even through all our conspiring, even in and through our enemies. The crowd shouts out a word that captures both praise and entreaty to God. Hosanna! Come help us right now! You are great! They use this as a cheerful chant, throwing in phrases from Psalm 118 that we've just recited together. It's a kind of rah-rah, here he is moment and feeling. One would think that this was the time now for Jesus to draw everyone around and speechify, to lay out the agenda of God's kingdom clearly, to make his case to the people. But he doesn't. He rides in on this young colt, Mark says. We discover from Matthew's gospel that it's a donkey, a deliberate humility that flies in the face of the hosannas. And it is my thought today that here we see the essential nature of God and God's kingdom. This is God's vision. There is no sense of capitulation to the populism on display as our politicians are wont to do in our democracies. Nor is there an attempt to become the strong man and lead from the front, the most dominant trend in the history of all human societies. Nor is this a compromise. Jesus isn't saying, let me just do my spiritual thing, and you keep doing what states and empires and leaders and soldiers have always done. For Jesus truly is a king, and he's accepting the hosannas. But one unlike humans have ever seen. And this is his humble entrance into the midst of human misunderstanding. You see, we want our politicians to do something. Just do something. To be special, to be bright, to be smart, to be innovative. And if none of these, at least attractive to look at. None of that seems to be in Jesus' mind. Indeed, the scene ends dramatically because it ends with precisely nothing. Nothing happens. Jesus goes into the temple, looks around, and leaves. And the misunderstanding only continues to compound. And here is where the famous prophetic words from Isaiah come in. All of the trials that will come to Jesus, until it all breaks under the weight of the blood-soaked beams in a few days' time. This is a vision, a politics, if you will, a spirituality, if you will, because it's all tied together, that draws out human response by not fulfilling human expectations. How would that ever work? Whatever it is, it's the beginning of a radical redefinition of power, of kingship, and by implication, what it means to be a citizen of such a kingdom. Even in the midst of the centuries, when the great conspiracy was at its height, this vision of God's humility among us in the person of Jesus was there. It continued to exist and be brought to the fore. It's so powerfully captured in our second reading, in Paul, that it could never be absent entirely. It is this great vision that is the energy of reform, the energy of things yet possible despite all of our human tendencies. If God has come among us in this way, as this kind of human being, as this kind of king, then God's kingdom of loving justice, still has the potential to redefine human existence. Because still, even after 2,000 years, it is largely unexplored. We can think of Christianity as old, as having seen its best days. But I don't think that's the New Testament understanding. I don't think Christ's vision of universal wholeness has yet been tried in a thoroughgoing way. The age of Christ is still dawning. The nations have yet to explore God's promises in the light of Christ's royal humility. As Paul sees it, all nations will see him without being forced to see him. All nations will take on a humility to match his, not because they have to, but because they've been won by his love. Many of us don't follow politics. Politics, especially as it's given to us in our contemporary media. And I don't blame people for not following that. I wonder sometimes how many hours I've wasted reading the news. But we are all political. We all have a part to play in human society. We are all part of the hive mind, if you will, that is pulled this way and that. Here at the beginning of Holy Week, we're asked to examine our commitment to God's kingdom, to God's way of influencing the world. Have we merely trivialized our Christian commitment so that we look to Christ to help us with our peace of mind while we look after everything else ourselves? As we leave the great conspiracy behind, what does it look like to commit to God's kingdom in our democracies? Democracies that were created to escape tyrants. And, truth be told, created to escape a church that thought it could force people to be good. Harangue them into becoming moral. Let's go with Jesus into Holy Week, into the humility of being misunderstood, and love as he loved, regardless what people say about us. The tide will turn, just not yet.